The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Each year, Fortune magazine lists the Fortune 500, the biggest companies in the world. I wonder if you can guess, well, it may have changed a little bit, there's a little bit of an arm wrestle going on, but in terms of market capital, the largest company in the world in September was?
Apple.
Well done, George. Apple. Let's see if we can get my Apple. Yeah, here we go. My Apple computer actually worked. Little product placement there. Yeah, Apple's market cap at the moment is 1.37 trillion Australian dollars. So that's, what is it, 1,300 billion Australian dollars. That's 11 times bigger than the Commonwealth Bank, and Steve Jobs started it just 42 years ago. Would you like to have a guess how many people Amazon employs around the world? Duncan, you're a business owner, you want to have a go? No? 563,000 around the world. And Jeff Bezos started it in 1994 in his garage. Just these massive companies. Now, I wonder if you're ever aware of just how big you work in the city, just how big these things are and how quickly they've grown, and the money and the power, etc. I walk around, I'm a follower of Jesus, I don't assume that everyone here is. But sometimes, and if you are, maybe you feel as well, in the middle of a big, powerful secular world that's getting on with the job and being successful and growing, faith in God can seem naive, a little childish, feeble. Where does faith in God fit in the big city? And not only does it feel like these other things are so big and powerful and growing so quickly, there's pressure to conform. If you follow Jesus, you may well feel what I feel. That's that pressure to just shut up on some issues. So the same-sex marriage or euthanasia or abortion or the transgender movement, just shut up and keep your head down. Now, the pressure here is nothing like in so many other countries where you can be sent to prison or beaten or worse, etc. But there's that pressure. And the question I'd like to look at over the next 4 weeks is, if you're a follower of Jesus, how do you respond or how do you live in that big, powerful world that seems to be able to ignore God and get on very well? If you're not a follower of Jesus, you can look over our shoulder and see whether that makes sense as you think about how would you respond. There's two possible wrong reactions. I've got the picture here of the drunk guy on the donkey and the cartoon that he falls off one side, gets on, then falls off the other side. The two possible wrong reactions are, well, sometimes Christian people think, well, we'll circle the wagons. We won't engage with the world that's not Christian at all. We'll block our ears. We won't listen, etc. We'll just huddle together. The other possible wrong reaction to fall off the other side of the donkey is, well, it's what my Staffordshire Terrier does each night when I come home. Musket just rolls over, shows me his belly and asks for a belly scratch. And then he'll follow me around the house. Or if it's dinner time, he will. And some Christian people, some churches will do that. And that is kind of give up, roll over, become just like the culture and not compromise on everything and follow the culture around like a puppy. Now, the book of Daniel in the Old Testament shows us that neither of those are the way to go. And the example of Daniel and his three friends is brilliant in that Daniel won't be seduced by power and promise, etc., privilege. And he won't be intimidated. There's another course that he follows. That's what I'd like to look with you today. In your handout is Daniel chapter 1. There's a number of different issues about the book of Daniel. For example, dating and the fact that there's what you might call miracles in the book. I hope to deal with those in more detail in the second and third weeks of this course of talks. But let's have a look. Daniel chapter 1, and I'll set the scene for you. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So the armies of the Babylonian Empire invaded, And in verse 2, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put them in the treasure house of his God. The Babylonians actually conquered Jerusalem three times, 605, 597 and 587. Each time they would come, conquer the city, put a puppet king in place, take the cream of the crop or the best of the population that they could and take them back to Babylon. Three successive waves. And you can see they go up to the north, avoid the desert there, but take them back to Babylon. Babylon, the ruins of Babylon are 113 kilometres south of Baghdad. I checked on Google just the other day. The Babylonian Empire was massive. As you can see, it stretched from up into modern-day Turkey, covered Iraq, over into what was then Persia, down into Egypt, and to Saudi Arabia. Huge. I think it was the biggest empire the world had seen up to that stage. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, as he had just begun to... Nebuchadnezzar had just begun his reign as he conquered Jerusalem or was about to be inaugurated as king the following year. He had a problem. That is, he had a massive empire with so many different ethnic groups and nationalities, etc. How do you govern an empire that big and that diverse? Now, he had the great advantage that he didn't have email or any of that sort of thing, so he could actually get some stuff done, right? But even not having email, it was still going to be difficult. So what did he do? Well, have a look at verse 3. What he came up with was a scheme to get the best and the brightest of the peoples that he had conquered to put them into a system with the Babylonians, a system of, well, you can call it education, indoctrination or brainwashing, depending on where you were standing, and let them help you run the empire. See verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Now, verse 5 is significant. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. So you choose the best of the best from around the empire, you bring them, you let them fall in love with the empire, and they help you run the show. Now, it's an idea that's been copied at other times in history. For example, Cecil Rhodes began, of course, the Rhodes Scholarship, made a gazillion dollars in Rhodesia, or what was then called Rhodesia. The Rhodes Scholarship, as people from all around the English-speaking world are taken to Oxford. Well, here's the college that Rhodes studied at, Oriel College in Oxford. As I spoke on Daniel 1 a number of years ago, there's a young lady, Elizabeth, I knew, who was actually a Rhodes Scholar at the time. She'd won a Rhodes Scholarship from the University of New South Wales. And I wrote to her and said, this thing in Daniel reminds me of a Rhodes Scholarship. Well, she wrote back in her usual articulate way. Here's what she said. She said, the Rhodes Trust was set up after he died in 1902. To quote from the Rhodes website, she says, quote, he dreamed of improving the world through the diffusion of leaders motivated to serve their contemporaries, trained in the contemplative life of the mind, broadened by their association with one another and by their exposure to cultures different from their own. Mr. Rhodes hoped that his plan in bringing able students from throughout the English-speaking world to study at the university where he took his degree in 1881 would aid in the promotion of international understanding and peace. She says, afterwards, actually, it was a little more sinister. The Rhodes Scholars were explicitly intended to promote the interests of the British Empire around the world. We were all supposed to come to Oxford, be captivated by the glories of England, and go forth as missionaries around the world to lead the colonies and to make sure that they acted in the interests of the empire. She goes on to list all of the criteria, and then once you're a Rhodes Scholar, how many doors just open? She's a very clever lady, and many doors have opened for her. So Daniel and his friends are I don't know whether offered is the word, perhaps conscripted into this... the greatest of all scholarships. Now, I know, look, Daniel, here's the thing. If you grew up in a Christian home or if you went to Sunday school, you know, Daniel's the book that launched a million Sunday school lessons. You've got the fiery furnace and the lion's den. But if you think into it as an adult, Can you imagine what it would have been like for these four, we'll meet them in just a moment in verse 6, these four very young men to be welcomed into something involving the most powerful man in the world and his administration? Imagine what it would be like travelling with a world leader and how impressive that would be. Well, here he is, Donald Trump. He's still there after the midterms. When Donald Trump went to the United Kingdom in July, his entourage was 1,000 people. 1,000. Motorcades, helicopters. How did he travel? Well, in Air Force One and then Marine One, and then they took his car, the presidential car, the Beast, which is bulletproof, bombproof. They even carry satchels of the president's blood in the boot in case something goes wrong. Or I saved the news clipping for 2007 when George W. came to Australia. When George W. came to Australia in 2007, he bought 5 chefs, 150 national security advisers, 250 secret service agents, 200 public servants, 50 political aides, and 15 sniffer dogs. It's a whole different world. Nebuchadnezzar's entourage, the palace, the king, the money would have been at least as impressive. And Daniel is invited to step into that world. As I said, I'm sorry, it's not a great, particularly clear map, but Babylon in ruins today, about 100 or so kilometres south of Baghdad. Today, it's just ruins. In its day, the most beautiful city in the world, the Ishtar Gates, taken by archaeologists in a museum in Berlin. It's interesting, isn't it? If you're a private citizen and you take something, it's theft. If you're wearing a pith helmet, you work for a government, it's archaeology. So that's the Ishtar Gates. We'll see more of those in coming weeks. And then we've got artist impressions of what the city would have looked like as it stood magnificent on the banks or on either side of the Euphrates River. Nebuchadnezzar built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, as I read, because one of his wives missed her mountain homeland. I'm sure there are a lot of labourers who wish she hadn't, but Babylon had walls. I can't remember if it was 27 kilometres or 27 miles of walls that were wide enough at the top for 2 chariots to pass. That's the size of the city. So Daniel and his friends are offered, how could I say, the world on a platter. And God's cause, you could easily have seen that the cause of the God of Israel seemed very weak at the time. See verse 6, we meet the characters involved in the book. Those who were chosen, who'd been brought out of Jerusalem, among those were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, each of those names come and are related to the God of Israel. Daniel means God is my judge, for example. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and Azariah, Abednego. Each of those names, and if you like later, I can tell you what they mean. I've got them footnoted. Each of those names derived from one of the gods of the Babylonians. But they accept the name changes. The Jewish boys accept the name changes. Why? Well, a contemporary of Daniel, the prophet Jeremiah, at the time when Babylon came and invaded, Jeremiah, or God through Jeremiah, is saying to the exiles in Babylon, settle down, you're going to be there for a long time. So if I could read, let me just read from Jeremiah 29, verse 4. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon: build houses and live in them. I'll jump a couple of verses. Give your wives and sons and daughters in marriage, etc. But seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you'll find your welfare. So you're going to be there a long time. Settle down, be cooperative, do the best for them. And so what you see in the story is Daniel and his three friends fit in terms of education. They learned the language and literature of the Babylonians. And it'd be all mixed up with there was no division in Babylon between religion and administration and law, etc., all mixed up together. I don't mean that they worshipped the Babylonian gods, but they lived in the thick of it and they understood the system and worked in it. So Daniel is offered the world on a platter, but the second half of the chapter is about the fact that he decided to, control his appetite. See verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. So he decided he would not eat from the king's table. Now the king, he's obviously not sitting across the table from the king and, you know, sharing napkins or whatever, but the food would come from the king's table. Daniel decided he wouldn't eat it. Here's a Sunday school picture of Daniel saying no to the food. You see, the artist has got it right. You see how young they are. At the time this happened, we don't know exactly how old Daniel and his friends were, but Daniel had at least a 64-year career in the Babylonian service of the king, 64-plus. So it's likely that he was just a teenager at this time. Now, why does he decide not to eat the food and wine from the king's table? The commentaries go on and on about different options. So some say, well, it was ritually unclean. He would have been offered pork to eat, and a Jewish boy couldn't eat pork. That's true, but why does he decide not to drink the wine? Why not have a couple of reds with whatever it is? He won't eat the food or the wine. Others have said, well, it's because that food would have been sacrificed to the Babylonian gods and he couldn't eat it because of that. That's more importing a New Testament issue back into the Old Testament. And also, if you read on, in Daniel chapter 10, after Daniel's had one of his wild dreams and visions that come later in the book, Daniel says, I didn't eat meat or drink wine for a couple of weeks after that. So as a young man, he says no. And an older man, he's eating meat, drinking wine. Tell you what I think the reason is. You weigh it up. I think it's because there's no free lunches. Right? There's no free lunches. If he accepts the food from the king, that builds relationship and obligation, and it's accepting that. One of the chief criticisms that the religious leaders made of Jesus in the way that he behaved was that he ate with sinners, that it built friendship and obligation, etc. You see it today. Why is it that businesses spend money on corporate boxes at the football for their customers, or harbour cruises, or whatever it is? Answer: hospitality brings obligation. We all know there's no free lunches. In fact, the Old Testament contrasts this. In one of the history books, 2 Kings, one of the captured kings of Israel, Jehoiachin, is taken out of prison. They said out of prison, and then he eats at the table of the king of Babylon every day. And I think we're meant to see the king eats at the table like a little lapdog, whereas Daniel says, no, I will not be bought. It's not exactly clear why he draws the line here, but he draws the line. It's a dangerous decision. You see verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would have my head because of you. So Nebuchadnezzar was not afraid to chop heads off, and the steward will not take the risk. So Daniel just quietly accepts that, and then steps down one rung lower in the what is literally the food chain. So you get to verse 11. Then Daniel said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. And so the guard took away their choice food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. And so what do we see? God honouring their decision. They eat the vegetables, water, etc. They look healthier and stronger. I also expect that the guard didn't have any trouble getting rid of the flash food and wine, etc. Then the story jumps forward 3 years to the end of their internship. See verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding in all kinds of literature and learning, so they understood they'd learned the culture and the way the system worked. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. That becomes significant next week. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. which is 539 BC. That's how we know he was, had at least 65 or so years in the civil service. Now, this chapter is an introduction. I'll show you next week the structure of the book of Daniel. This is an introduction. But it sets the scene for the life of Daniel and his friends. He's a very impressive character. Calm, solid, honourable, very successful in the job that he does. And he won't be seduced by the offer of food, wine, power and privilege. And he won't be intimidated. When you get to chapter 6, the story of the lion's den and so on, Daniel won't be intimidated. Now, why? It's because what Daniel's showing is, it's Daniel's worldview and what he understood about God meant that he could live a certain way. If you have a look at your sheet, as we read the story, you think, well, it doesn't seem like God's there very often. Well, you know, where does God turn up? If you read it carefully, there's actually three different times that God arrives. 1 verse 2, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Nebuchadnezzar took the city, yes, but God is the one who, the Lord is the one who gave the city to Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Because God had warned them again and again, right back in Deuteronomy, 1400 BC, God had said, "If in the land, if you walk away from me, if you ignore me, if you continue to break my laws, if you continue to mistreat people, etc., and greed dominates, etc., I'll throw you out of the land." And God had warned them for about 300 years, and then finally it happened. So you see, the first thing, Daniel understood God is the one who controls the nations and the big picture. The second time, see 1 verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. See, it's God who controls people's hearts. God changed the way this man looked at Daniel, and God is the one who controls people and the way that they behave. People are responsible for their own actions, but at the same time, God controls hearts and minds. And what that meant was that Daniel didn't need to fear other people. And the third one, I don't know if you noticed on the way through, verse 17, to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding and in all kinds of literature and learning. Daniel could understand visions. God's the one that gave them the gifts and abilities. What you see is Daniel and his friends, or particularly Daniel, brilliant administrator and manager and wise, and has this gift about discerning dreams. But they understand that God is the one who's given them that. And that means what? They can be humble. So when you've got, when you put those three together, God controls the big picture, God's the one who controls people as well, they're responsible, but God controls people, and God gives gifts and abilities, you can be confident and humble. And that's what you see in him as you read these little stories about him during his life. Alright, now let me go quickly. What does it mean? If you jump from the Old Testament Daniel to Jesus in the New Testament, and it is interesting that Jesus' main way of talking about himself comes from Daniel chapter 7, but we'll get to that. Jesus says, to follow him will cost. It will cost. I read you from Mark chapter 8, verse 34. Then he, Jesus, called the crowd. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. Deny yourself is the same word that's used about when Peter says, I don't know Jesus. What's he mean? To follow him means actually to say no to our own ambitions, our own agendas, to put him first. To take up the cross was to count your own life as over and to follow him. Notice he's gone first, but it will cost. It may mean that our job prospects are reduced. It may mean I won't get romantically involved with someone who doesn't follow Jesus because it just couldn't work. Or it might mean holding the line when you're being mocked about believing certain things. But it will cost. At the same time, Jesus promises that those who follow him will not miss out in this life or the next. So in the story, usually known as the rich young ruler, where the rich young man comes and asks Jesus, how do I have eternal life? Jesus says, give up your wealth. That was his functional God, and come and follow me. And he won't, walks away having given up nothing. Peter, one of the disciples, asks Jesus, and Peter spoke up, we have left everything to follow you. Truly I tell you, Jesus replied, no one who has left home or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for me and the gospel will fail to receive 100 times as much in this present age, homes, brothers, sisters, mothers, children and fields, along with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. What's he saying? Whatever you follow Jesus, whatever it costs it, you won't miss out in this life. No one who's truly followed Jesus will get to the end of their life and want a refund. That's what he's saying. And the promise of eternal life. And persecutions thrown in there as well, just in case. So let me tie it up. You may have questions. Remember we talked about the drunk man on the donkey falling one side or the other. In the big powerful world, when God's cause seems or feels weak, I'll talk next week about the fact that worldwide it's anything but that, but in our society it can. Wrong reaction: one, to circle the wagons and not listen and not engage. Daniel doesn't do that. The other wrong reaction is to roll over, ask for a belly rub and follow the world around like a puppy and give in on everything. Daniel won't do that. But what do we see him do? And I think this nails it. It meant that he could what? Cooperate. Wherever he could, he cooperated. But there are some things that he would not compromise on. So he cooperated where he could, but there are certain things that he would not compromise on. In other words, there are places where he drew a line in the sand. Now, because the New Testament gives the followers of Jesus principles to apply rather than hundreds of rigid little rules, Christian people will draw the lines in different places. But I think Daniel chapter 1 is saying, if you're going to follow Jesus, you may draw the lines in slightly different places, but there will need to be lines. You will have to draw lines on things you will not do or things you will not cross. Let me just give you a couple of examples. These aren't meant to be chiselled in sand, but you might say, look, I work really well in my job. I'll go the extra mile. I will be the best employee in the company. But I will not sell my soul to the job. I will not breach my own ethical standards. Or I will go out for a drink on Friday afternoon with everyone. And have a good time, but I'll only have two drinks and I will not get drunk. Or I will go home at 7 o'clock, or whatever it is, wherever you draw the line. Or family-wise, you may be in your family where you are the only follower of Jesus. You may say, I will love everyone in my family. I will be the best son or daughter on the planet. I will be faithful, respectful, but I will not give up my faith and I will not stop going to church. They're just examples. Lines that will need to be drawn. I will cooperate where I can, but there are things that I will not compromise on.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.